compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Welcome back. We have 2 hours to go, and it's going to go by quickly. So if you're wanting to call in and be on the air, just call 888-914-9149. I am coming to your phone calls here in just a minute. First, though, interesting article in Life News. 48 Christian churches, I think most of them are Catholic churches, in Canada have been burned down or vandalized as persecution continues. Video footage shows a woman attempting to light a Canadian church on fire days before the church was burned to the ground. Surrey Royal Canadian Mounted Police said in a press release that St. George Coptic Orthodox Church was destroyed in an early Monday morning blaze, the cause of which is still under investigation. The fire is being treated as suspicious, particularly in light of video surveillance footage obtained by CTV Vancouver showing a woman attempting to light the church on fire last Wednesday. Authorities have not established that the incidents are connected. Huh, I wonder if those are connected. Someone's trying to light this church on fire, and then a few days later, the church gets lit on fire and burns down. It's hard to say if those incidents are connected. I guess probably not. The church, attended by more than 380 families, also served as a daycare to 65 children. Bishop Mina of the Coptic Orthodox Diocese of Mississauga, Vancouver, in Western Canada, said, "We will not be deterred and we will rebuild." The timing for this fire, he said, raises many questions about what the authorities did to protect our church, especially considering the attempt on the same church this past Wednesday. The Mounties, they told the news outlet that though it is investigating the crimes against the churches, it does not have statistics on how many churches have been vandalized or burned. However, the Canadian publication True North has counted a minimum of 48 Christian churches in Canada that have either been vandalized, desecrated, or burned down since unmarked graves were uncovered near residential schools for Indigenous children. As someone on Twitter pointed out, if it were 48 abortion clinics that had been burned down, would the press give this more attention? So the backstory here is that in these residential homes for children, these are Indigenous children. So Kamloops was perhaps the most, it was maybe one of the first ones to become known several months ago. And as the story developed and they were finding graves and the bodies of children who were in these graves, the first iteration of the story was that these were sort of unmarked graves or mass graves where the bodies of these children had been unceremoniously dumped by Catholics. That's the typical narration or narrative on this story. Even though these were actually government homes owned and operated by the government in Canada, and many of them were administered, it is true, by Catholics, especially Catholic religious orders. So I don't mean to suggest that there's no connection to the Catholic Church. There certainly is one. And there is a scandal there, to be sure. But as things developed, it also became clear that some of these things that were being called mass graves were not mass graves. They were just overgrown cemeteries. And they found that these children had been duly buried in a proper way with a headstone or a grave marker in some cases, a cross perhaps. And over time, they got so overgrown that when they were discovered, it didn't immediately appear to be a cemetery. You don't hear that much about that aspect of the story, but in the wake of these discoveries and in the wake of the furor that has erupted in Canada, you don't really hear much about that now in the United States. You really haven't heard much about it here. I've talked about it a time or two, maybe three or four times on the program, but not that much. The demands for formal apologies from Pope Francis and from local bishops, this is a continuing thing. I think it's a good thing, honestly. If there is any, or to the extent that there is any Catholic involvement, I think it's a good thing for the bishop to apologize. Obviously, he didn't do anything wrong. And obviously, the Catholic folk in that area today did not do anything wrong. But if it, in fact, is the case that some of these Catholic figures in religious orders or what have you, if they were complicit in the mistreatment of these children, then absolutely an apology should be forthcoming. But as I understand it, this has happened over and over and over again. And bishops have formally apologized. And yet, I think as an act of revenge, some people are trying to get back at the Catholic Church by burning down not only Catholic churches, but Christian churches in general. The New York Post's Kelly Jane Torrance criticized media outlets for suggesting that Canada had hidden what are called genocidal death camps. Torrance wrote, "The unmarked graves are confirmations of a sad history Canadians have always known rather than discoveries." Canada's Truth and Reconciliation Report, released in 2015, found that thousands of children died from disease in the overcrowded schools and that lack of supervision allowed for abuse and neglect. "This is not a mass grave site," Saskatchewan's First Nation Chief Cadmus Delorme said on June 24th. He says these are unmarked graves. So he's pointing out the fact that it's not what it appeared to be at first glance. Torrance said the findings were shocking but not surprising. As a schoolgirl in Canada, she said, "I learned the ugly history of the country's forced assimilation policy. Over the course of a century, 150,000 Native children were torn from their families by force if necessary and sent to get an education in English or French language in government-funded schools run mainly by the Catholic Church." Torrance wrote that most of the clergy in charge were well-meaning, but that some took advantage of their position to inflict abuse. So, it's a real problem, no question about it, historically. We can look back on this and say that was handled very badly. And again, as you've heard me say before, if there's a real problem, we should not whitewash it. We should not attempt to sweep it under the rug or pretend it didn't exist. We should deal with those issues head on. But at the same time, people should not be burning down Catholic churches and other churches as houses of worship, because that act of revenge will only further exacerbate tensions, if you ask me. So that's the story as it stands at the moment. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Greg in Fort Myers, Florida. Hi, Greg.
Yes, hi. I just wanted to ask or just share a thought about the vaccines and people not wanting to get them. Just from a financial standpoint alone, I haven't heard anyone raise this issue or point. Mm-hmm. From a financial standpoint alone, a hospital stay would cost a family hundreds, thousands, lost work. The shot is free, even if, and there are some shots, from what I learned from your show, that the Catholic Church has gotten behind, mm-hmm. As appropriate. It's a free shot. If it saves somebody a hospital stay, again, thousands of dollars, medicine and, mm-hmm. and everything else that goes along with it, I just can't see the logic behind saying, objecting to it as a Catholic. But that's just a thought. That's just my personal thought I wanted to share. Mm-hmm.
I think many people, perhaps most, share the same view that you have, and I don't disagree with you. Knowing people personally who object to the vaccine and who have not gotten it, my impression is that for many of them, it's the rushed nature of getting this ready for people without all of the typical trials that go into testing drugs before they're brought to market like this. I've detected that in some people's concern. Another one is, they're concerned about, if Bill Gates is behind this, and we know he is in terms of funding research and such, and we also know that Bill Gates has a long and sordid track record of not only supporting but also even funding anti-population measures, and if he's involved with this, some people are saying, well, how do I know what's in this vaccine? How do I know that there may not be something harmful or anti-population related? Some people are concerned about that. Other people just say, if 98% of the people who get this are fine, I'll take my chances. I mean, I hear that as well. So I don't want to give anyone the impression that I'm saying don't get a vaccine. I'm not saying that. I've never said that. I have no problems with vaccines per se. But just trying to reflect what I hear from other people in discourse, I think it's not just one thing that people are saying, I don't want to get it. There are a variety of different reasons why people that I hear say it are saying it. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I maybe I should have said this, but I didn't want to prolong the call. I had COVID before people even knew about it. I called my doctor. They basically told me to drink a lot of fluids. There's something going around. Mm-hmm. This was several months before it wasn't even talked about. Then they did the test and they found that in my blood. But it was a horrible experience. I didn't go to the hospital. Maybe I should have, looking back. But and then I got the shot anyway because I really and this is just me. And believe me, I have a lot of faith in what you say and Relevant Radio. But I'm just looking at it from, you know, they say, you know, the average American has less than $500, $1,000. I mean, a hospital stay would be devastating.
True, but consider that let's assume that the average person who would be in that scenario has some form of insurance. Well, the way I understand these things to go, once you've reached your annual deductible, everything else is covered by the insurance company. So let's say it did run up into the millions of dollars or something like that. Well, that would be above and beyond your deductible up to a certain point, I guess. So most people would not feel the brunt of that kind of financial impact. The insurance companies certainly would, but the average Joe would not be paying. I mean, how can you pay $1 million if you're the average Joe? You can't do it. So it would get absorbed. But your point is still a good one, and that is, you know, if you're going to get the jab and it's uncomfortable versus maybe going to the hospital for weeks and incurring a great debt, obviously, if you do a cost-benefit analysis, it makes more sense to get the vaccine if you're looking at it that way, right?
And that's my point. That you summed it up with a lot fewer words than I, you know, mm-hmm. offered. But it just, and not only that, I mean, even just going in the hospital opens up. There's so many. Just going in the hospital is kind of risk. It just seems like you say when you do the analysis. From a financial point, loss of work point, from just a standard of living. I mean, just how your whole life would be turned upside down. I just can't, you know, and I had it and I got the shot because I said to myself, that's free. That's free. I mean,
yeah, you can go down to your local CVS and get it.
Yes, sir. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Well, I hope you stay safe and healthy, Greg. And I'm glad you raised this question. Thank you for that. I want to share this with you, as long as we're on the topic, then we'll go back to your phone calls. This is an article by Shelley Talcott in the Daily Caller. The CDC is considering mask mandates for vaccinated Americans. White House Chief Medical Officer, Advisor Dr. Anthony Fauci said that the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, is considering recommending masks for vaccinated individuals as the Delta variant continues to surge. Fauci spoke on CNN's State of the Union about COVID-19 and was asked about one projection that suggests cases will still continue rising if more Americans don't get vaccinated. He confirmed, saying that, quote, it's not going to be good, and declared the country is going in the wrong direction. You heard a little bit of audio to that effect earlier in the program today. He also warned that the CDC is discussing mask mandates for people who have been fully vaccinated. This is under active consideration, he told CNN. If you're asking me, he says, if you're asking, am I part of the discussion? Yes, I am part of the discussion. But I think what you're seeing, even though as of our conversation at this moment, the CDC still says and recommends that if you are fully vaccinated, that you do not need to wear a mask indoors. And we played some audio to that effect, but this is why I'm bringing it up again. Because you can imagine why people may be saying to themselves, okay, well, all right, they want me to get vaccinated. And again, I need to say this for the umpteenth time. I'm not saying to anybody, don't get vaccinated. It's not what I'm saying. It's not even what I'm suggesting. I'm just pointing out that as the government itself is saying, there's a significant number of people in this country, not quite half, but getting close to that, who for whatever reason are not getting vaccinated. So it's a real issue. Certainly in the eyes of the government, it's a real issue. And I can see why people are saying in that category, well, wait a minute, if they're saying, I got to get vaccinated because that's the solution. And if everybody gets the jab, that's the solution. And now they're saying, but yet I still have to wear a mask and I still have to maybe even socially distance. And I mean, I hope that as we go through this, you can see that part of the problem is this lurching from one side to another, the information that's given that doesn't always match up, inconsistencies, moving the goalposts, saying that this is going to be great once you do this, and then you do that, and they say, oh, but it's not great. this is one of the problems that besets us when it comes to analyzing this issue of COVID-19 and the vaccines and such, because there's so much, it's not clear and precise and consistent. It's the opposite of those things. And it's no wonder that some people who already might be a little bit skittish, who are already maybe a little bit worried about Bill Gates, and then they see this circus, and they say, well, they told me it would be okay if I got the vaccine, and now they're saying it doesn't matter, you still have to wear a mask. I think that's a big part of what's going on here. If we don't take that into account, you'll never understand why some people are saying they're not interested in taking the vaccine.
If you disobey the rules, you get cut off.
Ain't it the truth? And you'll also be, I think, in the not too distant future, if you're not vaccinated, you're very likely to be penalized, to be scapegoated. I have the feeling, and it just seems to me, that the sort of the gathering rhetoric in the media, more and more steady drumbeat, building and building, to scapegoat the people who are not vaccinated. In what way exactly, I'm not sure. Right now, they're just saying, let's make life miserable for those people. Let's make life miserable so that they'll bend because they can't take it anymore, and they'll just say uncle and they'll get vaccinated. And what happens if you still have people who are holding out? What then? So we do the best we can. And I certainly am not, as I say, I'll just say it again, I'm not anti-vaccine. I have no problems with vaccines. I've received many vaccines in my lifetime. I'm not in any way against them. And I feel as though, I mean, I shouldn't even have to say this, but we do get these angry emails from people. Patrick was saying, don't get a vaccine. I'm not saying that. Okay. For the record, let's go to Pamela in Wisconsin. Good morning, Pamela.
Good morning, Patrick. Thank you for taking my call.
You're most welcome.
I have to want to share with you about my husband real quick. But after I do that, can you please let me make a point that about the vaccine as well?
I'll do the best I can. I mean, I'm welcoming your comments, but I can't turn this into a soapbox. But go ahead, Pamela.
Oh, no. I just want to. Okay, first of all, my husband had lymphoma in the liver. And it actually did take his life. He's passed away a couple months ago.
I'm so sorry.
But his oncologist, thank you, his oncologist and our family physician did not want him to have the vaccine for whatever reason. I don't remember. So, like I said to the your producer, he wasn't, if he was supposed to live, you know, if God wanted him to live and he couldn't have this shot, and we wanted to go to Italy or something, he couldn't go. What do we people do that we shouldn't really have the shot? They've never addressed that. What if you medically shouldn't have this shot? What are we supposed to do?
I think, as I understand it, that if you are not supposed to have the shot, then you have some kind of exemption. But I don't know if that will spare you from the wrath of all the people out there who see this as almost a religious cause, that, you know, they must get everyone vaccinated. I'm not sure if they take those exceptions into account, Pamela.
Probably
and
not.
Furthermore, I don't know how at a practical level in just day-to-day society, in grocery stores and restaurants and sporting events, venues and things, I don't know how the average person who holds those views would deal with somebody who doesn't have a vaccine and has a reason not to have a vaccine. I don't know how that will play out either.
Quickly, these illegals that Biden's letting in, are they getting vaccinated as soon as they cross the border? Because
of course
in Mexico, they're not aggressive with their vaccines. I've done a lot of research on that. So they're coming. All of a sudden, we have a rise in COVID again. I mean, you kind of like put two and two together. You know what I'm saying?
Gentlemen,
I mean, they're coming in. They're not vaccinated.
A gentleman asked that very question at the first part of the first hour of the show today. And I have no knowledge about, you know, the protocols that are undertaken when people come in. But from everything I can see, it doesn't appear as though there's that speed bump, like, okay, 1.6 million people or whatever the figure is that have come in thus far this year. I don't see evidence that they are being forced to get vaccinated before they're dispersed throughout the country. often at government expense.
Isn't that hypocrisy?
It kind of is, isn't it? I know. How weird that the government would be hypocritical on matters like that, isn't it?
Yes. Well, thank you.
Who would have thunk it, right?
Good day.
Thank you. I appreciate your phone call. Let's take a break and come back with more of your phone calls. We'll come straight to you right after this quick timeout. So if you're holding, thank you for your patience. I'll be right back. Notre Dame Federal Credit Union is a member of the Catholic Credit Unions of America. You can find more information and your local Catholic Credit Union at relevantradio.com/banking.
This is the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and relevantradio.com. Get connected to the conversation. Call now, 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid is on now.
We are back. Thank you for listening. John in Chicago, it's good to have you on the program, sir. Welcome.
Thank you, Patrick. When we were younger and growing up and they taught the catechism, a mortal sin was, you know, a serious matter, a sufficient reflection, and full consent of the will. So that, you know, something that was serious. But right. Recently I've been hearing so many, and I mean this with great respect, so many, mm-hmm. even one of our priests saying, well, nobody really commits a mortal sin. And I'm thinking, how is that possible? You know, and the sort of the idea I get behind it as I listen is that you have to deliberately turn against God and say, well, I'm going to do this. I know, you know, no matter what. I don't think people do that. Even this is a minor example, but what if a person misses Mass through no fault of their own because, oh, I don't know, they have bear tickets and they're going to get down to the game before, you know, they just can't miss mm-hmm. that, but they'll miss Mass. So I was going to get your opinion, and I don't know if you thought about this or reflected on it or heard others. It's almost, when you listen to some people, it's almost like, well, nobody really commits a mortal sin in my parish. And it to me, from what I've learned, that doesn't make sense.
I would agree with you. And I'm tempted to wonder if the person who says that is just trying to assuage his own guilty conscience. Because if you are maybe in, you know, indulging in your own sins, it becomes that much more uncomfortable to even talk about sin. Now, that's only a surmise. I don't know. In any given case, it's hard to say. Only God knows. But that could be one motivation for it. I don't know. But strictly speaking, let's go old school here. Let's look at, as you were asking me the question, I got the Baltimore Catechism that I have such high regard for. And let's start in question 64. This gets to the heart of what you're saying here. What is actual sin? Actual sin is any willful thought, desire, word, action, or omission forbidden by the law of God. How many kinds of actual sin are there? There are two kinds of actual sin, mortal sin and venial sin. What is mortal sin? Mortal sin is a grievous offense against the law of God. Why is this sin called mortal? This sin is called mortal or deadly because it deprives the sinner of sanctifying grace and the supernatural life of the soul. Besides depriving the sinner of sanctifying grace, what else does a mortal sin do to the soul? Besides depriving the sinner of sanctifying grace, mortal sin makes the soul an enemy of God, takes away the merit of all its good actions, deprives it of the right to everlasting happiness in heaven, and makes it deserving of everlasting punishment in hell. And then the last of the questions that pertain to this, what are the three things necessary to make a mortal sin? To make a mortal sin, these three things are necessary. First, the thought, desire, word, action, or omission must be seriously wrong or considered seriously wrong, meaning that maybe the thing itself isn't seriously wrong, but you think it's seriously wrong, and you decide to do it anyway. The second contributing factor is the sinner must be mindful of the serious wrong, and third, the sinner must fully consent to it. So to put it in brief, serious matter, sufficient reflection, and full consent of the will. So to your point, John, when somebody suggests that, well, nobody in my parish commits a mortal sin, I would say then everybody in your parish must be hooked up to you know, intravenous feeding tubes and things. Not intravenous, but they must be in comas. Because if you're not in a coma and you have the possibility of a thought, a desire, a word, an action, or an omission that could be seriously wrong, the likelihood that you could at least be tempted to do those things is quite high. And we all go through those temptations ourselves. So it's merely wishful thinking, not on your part, but it's merely wishful thinking to imagine that, you know, of the 500, 600, 1,000 families in this parish, that nobody ever commits a serious sin. I mean, obviously, that's ridiculous on the face of it. So,
and I agree with you, Patrick. And I'm thinking, too, you know, we know that we go to church on Sunday. And I mean this with great respect, even for the professions, medical, legal, accounting, and the like. Sometimes people are put in situations where they're made to compromise with our, you know, true beliefs as Catholics. And so if you want to be a part of these practices, you have to go along with it. And it's almost like a Catholic politician saying, oh, I would never have an abortion myself. But who am I to deny that to somebody else? I mean, that would be like saying, you know, as you have said, too, it'd be like, I don't believe in slavery, but who am I to deny that to someone else if they want to do it?
Exactly.
And so if they support these things, that's a serious sin, even though they try to back out of it by saying, I'm not for it, but I'll vote for it because my. So that's a serious matter that they're dealing with. They know what they're doing, and nobody's holding a gun to their head to, you know, to make that vote.
What you're referring to, John, and this is good information, you're referring to participation in a sin. So in something that is intrinsically evil, let's say abortion as an example, always and everywhere wrong. There's no circumstance where an abortion can be legitimate in a moral sense. And whatever your level of participation in that sin is, causes you to be culpable in some way. Now, you could be very remotely connected to it, in which case you're not culpable at all. You may not even realize that you have some connection to it. You may not even realize that the materials that your lumber store is providing, the nails and the wood and things, that's going to build an abortion clinic. You may not realize that you're participating, but your participation is so remote and unintentional that there's no culpability on your part. But if you are the contractor and you get the contract from Planned Parenthood, hey, we need you to build us another abortion clinic, and you know that that's what you're building, well, you are directly participating in that. And your level of culpability, of course, is present and goes way up. So part of the discussion, or any discussion about the nature of sin, and in particular mortal sin, should include explaining to people how you can wind up becoming complicit in something, even if you're just taking the lazy way out and saying, well, I would never do that, but I'm gonna help out and do something that would facilitate that. So it seems to me, John, that the problem may be best served by greater catechesis. And this is what we try to do on Relevant Radio, of course. We try to raise people's consciousness and help them understand what the church teaches so that they won't be caught thinking that, well, nobody ever really commits a mortal sin. That's just simply not true.
Absolutely. You know, and I think, too, it's not to cast aspersions on anybody, but I you know, you do get concerned when you listen to this because... And the old school, Patrick, they said, well, kids learned by rote. Did they really understand what they were learning? But we memorized it. Did we fully understand it when we were in grammar school? No. As you grow older, you, you do.
I don't mean that I fully understood it in grammar school. What I meant was I memorized these things by rote, like you probably did too. And it stuck. And the older I got and the more I could understand it, the better I understood it because I had assimilated it that way.
And the point was that we both had a foundation to fall back on as we got older. But if it wasn't taught by rote, we still wouldn't. What would we have to fall back on? And so I really think when people hear these things, oh, do you really commit a mortal sin? It's the deadening of consciences. But they're still culpable if they know that it is a serious matter in the eyes of the church. And they still somehow, directly or indirectly, support that. So, that, you know, I thank you for, you know, you're clarifying it. And I just think, again, it's another sad situation where good Catholics can allow their consciences to go dead.
But you know what, John? The upside to that is relevant radio. And we can see that as a silver lining. And that's why we're here, to help people get to heaven. So we are day in and day out, 24/7, we are looking for ways to try to help educate people on these issues. So you've clearly identified the problem, and accurately so. And we're trying to be the solution. So thank you, John. I appreciate it. And by the way, one great way to prove what John is saying is you look at a parish that offers very little by way of the sacrament of confession, also known as reconciliation. You'll see very few people going to the sacrament of confession. If it's not emphasized, if it's not made available, if it's, well, okay, I guess a half an hour on Sunday, you know, from 4:30 to 5, you will find that very few people take advantage of it. But in those parishes, and I belong to one, by the way, that is magnanimous in its offering of the sacrament of confession, you'll find people driving for an hour or more just to get to that parish to go to confession. So just to brag on my parish just a little bit as an example here, there are other parishes that are like this, but I wish there were more. But in my parish, the friars offer confession before and after every single Mass every single day. And if you need to go to confession and you're not available at those times, you call the priest up and they'll arrange for you to go to confession. You can make an appointment for that. But the lines are long, and even like before Mass is even over, people are already lining up. And by lining up, I mean like for one confessional booth before Mass is over, you might have 10 or 15 people already in line. And the priest will hear confessions for as long as it takes. They don't say, oh, sorry, I'm off the clock now, and leave 10 people in line. They hear until the very last confession is heard. That's how dedicated and devoted they are to this. And my point is simply that people, when they find out about it, they come by droves and they come for miles. And the meaning there is people realize, if I've committed a mortal sin, I want to go to confession. And in the parishes that explain that and make that available, people take advantage of it in a good sense. 888-914-9149. Let's go now to Sparta, Wisconsin, and talk to Mary. Hi, Mary.
Hi. So my comment today is kind of circles back around to the vaccine and everything that's going on with the rise again. No one ever talks about the importance of educating people on how to build their immune system and how important the food that we have in our country and the beauty that God put here had everything figured out with putting medicine in our seeds, plants, fruits, everything that we grow. He had a reason for it. It was filled with antioxidants. It was filled with, you know, anti-inflammatory components. Like,
let me interrupt if I may, Mary. I'm puzzled by your statement. Nobody ever talks about it. We have a multi-billion dollar industry in food supplements and holistic organic foods. It seems that there's a huge amount of attention on how important natural remedies are, and taking advantage of the, you know, the health benefits of eating clean, as they say, and eating healthy. I mean, I see it exactly the opposite. There's a massive discussion going on everywhere about those who want people to understand exactly the point you're making. I hear people talk about it a lot, don't you?
Oh, I agree with you as far as there's people trying to get the word out. But when I look at, like, where Dr. Fauci is so quick to want to get everybody to wear their mask, get the vaccine, where have we heard information on maybe going to the school programs? And, yes, they do things in the line of lunch, but has people really looked what it is they're giving kids? Corn dog, little mini corn dogs, and processed things and packaged things, instead of going back to a little bit more of a basic.
I think
food.
Michelle Obama, that was her main program, if I'm not mistaken, as First Lady. I think she was at the forefront of promoting healthier food for public school children.
She was, but then you have Bill Gates, who is buying up agriculture land and coming up with his synthetic beef, and he's tapping into the seed world. Again, tapping into the very thing we need to sustain life is food.
Yeah, I agree. So help me out here. What's the bottom line point you want to make in light of all those things?
Well, I guess is let food be your medicine and medicine be your food. And I don't think we look at that as powerful as it can be. When it's the flu season, everyone wants to get a flu shot, when in fact it's really the sugar season, because from, you know, basically Halloween through Valentine's Day or Easter, we are filling our kids with pounds and pounds of sugar. Well, sugar is as addicting as heroin. It weakens your immune system.
I agree with you. I don't doubt the veracity of the point that you're making, but are you suggesting that if only we ate healthier food, we would not have to worry about the coronavirus? Or, and I realize the coronavirus is not as virulent as a number of other things that are quite prevalent. Are you saying that people wouldn't get sick at all if they just ate better?
No, I do think that if they were a little bit more conscientious of what they ate, and if we kind of looked back to the organizations that are in charge of our food, why would have energy drinks ever been passed and put on out for human consumption, or vaping or anything else? Like, we have organizations, we pay people to look at these foods before they're released to our our public, to our all of our brothers and sisters, and knowing that they're not safe, but people don't tend to dig for the information about how horrible they can be for themselves. So they think if it's on the shelf, it must be safe, it got passed, and they go ahead and buy it. And so I just look at the childhood diabetes and the obesity, and then you look into our food banks and pantries, and what do we stock with? Probably some of the worst food that can be out there because it's cheap and available.
I've got to run, Mary.
So educating.
I don't doubt your points. I don't doubt it a bit. If we ate better, we would be healthier, no doubt. But I do think that, there's a limit to that, especially when it comes to things like cancer, etc. Mary, thank you. I appreciate it. I'll be right back. This hour is sponsored by Ave Maria Mutual Funds, where financial goals are aligned with pro-life values, and fund decisions are based on investment fundamentals designed to preserve and grow wealth without violating moral beliefs. More information at AveMariaFunds.com.
Keeping it relevant. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Join the conversation at 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. The Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Miss Ellie Burnett, one of our charter members of Team Taco on Twitter. Shout out to Team Taco members, by the way. You know who you are. She posted this to me. She said, just a reminder, a genuinely deadly pandemic doesn't require 24/7 advertising to remind you that it exists. Real pandemics don't need marketing campaigns and endless propaganda, but psychological operations do. You know, Miss Ellie, I think you have articulated with this image that you posted to me the mindset of many people in this country. You know, that they, for whatever reason, I was talking to my wife about this the other day, and I'll share with you some thoughts. For whatever reason, and I suppose there are a variety of reasons, but there are people, I know some of them, for whom this is not real. They don't think it's real. They don't take it seriously. And of course, there are reasons for them to feel vindicated in that. Well, they say, you know, if 98% of people are going to get this and be fine, or not seriously harmed by it, then why should I consider this to be the end of the world? I know people who feel that way. I was talking with Nancy over the weekend. We were having a cup of coffee and just sort of discussing why it is that there's so much anger that's going on. And one of my thoughts, I'll share this with you, and this is not directly about COVID per se. This gets into other areas. This actually gets into the Catholic Church and anger in some parts against the bishops, anger against priests, people who are quick to support and lionize and extol, maybe say a priest who disobeys his bishop. And I have some thoughts about that. I want to offer you this. At least it's something I'm still mulling over, but I'm becoming more and more convinced that there is a fusion. There has become a kind of fusion of religious frustration on the part of, let's say, Catholics who see kind of a leftward trend in the Catholic Church, and the clerical sodomy networks, and priests and bishops and cardinals and others falling from grace because of leading double lives and sexual predation against children, and it being covered up by bishops, and, you know, a lot of that kind of thing, as well as a kind of political frustration. Those who are frustrated, and I'm talking here about those who are politically conservative, who are frustrated during the Obama administration for 8 years. And then maybe they saw the next administration as a bit of a respite, and then they are angry because it didn't go, it did, that didn't continue, and now we have Biden in office and the rise of a more muscular form of the Democratic Party pushing back against many things that we hold dear, like traditional marriage as an example. I guess the best way I could put it is my sense is that there's an amalgamation of anger that is both political and religious that has become somewhat alloyed and is now seeking targets. And I wonder if maybe a large part of the rage and even, well, let's just say rage and a distrust about things like the vaccine and whether or not this whole COVID thing is as bad as people make it out to be and so on and so forth. I'm trying to speak in the voice of people who I know who have these feelings, okay? So I'm not telling you that this is how I feel. I'm just trying to describe what I'm hearing from some people. And I get the impression that there is now this sort of alloyed or fused anger and frustration that is both religious and political. And it winds up being directed at whoever the offending party may be at any given time without recourse to whether or not that's a religious issue or a political issue. So anyway, in a nutshell, that's the thought. I think about this a lot as I consider how fragmented our society has become and how polarized people have become. And when people say there are two Americas now, I understand what that means now. I don't think it was true before, but people who want it to be true, and I'm talking now about people on the left, for example, who want nothing more than to keep people riled and keep them antagonized and keep them suspicious and fearful and angry and judgmental, they have a vested interest in doing so because they can control people that way. You can keep your opposition off balance, and you can control the people that are in line with what you think. So they have a reason for wanting this to be the way it is. This is the opposite of what Jesus wants, if you ask me. But they want it because they can control you.
Fear they can... will keep the local systems in line.
Where have I heard that before? I think it's true. And the more it goes, the more I think it's true. The more real I think it is that all of this turmoil and the anger and division, all the things I just described, I think it's calculated by those who want it to be this way so that they can control things. So I'll leave it at that. 888-914-9149. Yvette, you have been so patient waiting in California. Thank you for waiting and welcome to the program.
Hi, good morning, Patrick. I have a question regarding blessed and exercised, I guess, holy water and salt by a priest. Okay. I have a question. Do blessed things, can they be sold?
No, strictly speaking, no, they can't be. There's a sin known as simony, and that has to do with back in the book of Acts, there was a magician whose name was Simon, and he approached some of the apostles and he said, hey, you guys are doing some pretty cool tricks. I'd like to know how to do that. How much money do you want to teach me how to do this? And he was rebuked and he was told, we can't sell this to you. This is from God. And it's not for sale. We can't sell it even if we wanted to, and we don't want to. So from that biblical incident arose the recognition of simony as a sin if somebody is trafficking in holy things or blessed items, things of that nature. Hey, if you pay me $100, I'll show you how to, you know, perform this sacrament or something like that. So the church has always rejected that. And in a maybe a less dramatic form, that would take the shape of if somebody said, I have a blessed crucifix here, I'll sell it to you. Well, the church says you can't buy and sell blessed items. So nobody buys and sells blessed holy water anyway, or holy water that I know of. Did you have another example in mind?
Yeah, like, for example, there is a priest that I guess I want to say sell or, you know, make a donation, quote, to quote, so and say for exercised holy water and salt and oil.
No, he should not be doing that. That would be, if not simony, it would certainly be verging on simony. The priest has an obligation in justice to provide the sacraments. Now, those are not sacraments, of course, but to provide the sacraments, and by extension, you could say sacramentals, he has an obligation by in justice to provide that for his parishioners. But as at a general level, priests have an obligation in charity to do what they can. Even if it's not a matter of justice, they're not strictly required to supply the holy things to the people. In charity, they should do so. And to charge money for it smacks of simony. So if the priest says, hey, I'll give you a vial of blessed holy water, you know, and that is what holy water is in any case, or exercise salt, but you got to give me $5 for it, I would just turn my back on him and walk away because he's not doing something he should be doing.
Oh, okay. Yeah, it's just, you know, it's just it happens to be right after Mass, you know, there's people there, you know, inside the side of the church, and they say, okay, you know, if you ask for, quote, to quote, a packet, and that's what the packet includes, is holy water.
And who's this? Who's the money going to?
I believe the church.
Well, this is maybe a bit of a gray area. If the priest were, if he had a card table set up in the vestibule, and he said, "Look, I've got these packets with blessed salt and some holy water, and that'll be $5, please." No, that to my mind would be simony, and I would say absolutely not. If the priest is saying, you know what, we have these kits for you, you take them home, bless your homes, things like that, and if you want to cover the cost of the plastic bottle, and I mean, it just seems so negligible, but let's say that there was some actual cost. If you'd like to make a donation to the parish to cover the cost of that, I could see that maybe, but even still, it just has the appearance of simony. So I would avoid that too, if at all possible. I mean, it sounds as though the expense would be negligible to put those little packets together. Mm-hmm. So
that does exist, you know, exercise the holy water and exercise blessed salt as well.
Mm-hmm. I would say absolutely not. Don't sell it. Give it away.
Okay. No, I'm not selling it. I'm just...
No, I'm not saying... I know. You're describing a situation at your parish.
Uh-huh. You know,
All right. Well, if I were the bishop and I found out that Father McGillicuddy was selling blessed salt and exercised holy water, I'd say, knock it off, Father McGillicuddy. Make it available for your people as needed, but don't sell it. It just sends the wrong signal, as I think we've seen. Thank you. Let's go to Thomas now in Bettendorf, Iowa. Hi, Thomas.
Morning, Patrick.
Good morning.
Just had a question about the reception of the Eucharist on the tongue versus in the hand, and just kind of why the reception on the tongue is viewed as more reverent than in the hand. I'm thinking of this in light of a couple things. So the Gospels, I don't recall them specifying necessarily how the disciples actually received the body and blood. And then secondly, just thinking about what happens to the Eucharist after we consume it, it enters our digestive tract. I mean, I don't really see the difference between the host passing from consecrated hands to unconsecrated hands to ultimately our digestive tract. So just wondering if you had any opinions on that.
Sure. And those are valid questions. Let's take the second one first. The real presence of Christ remains in the host and in the precious blood for as long as it retains its external integrity as the thing that it once was. What I mean is, before the consecration, the host is bread, has all the properties of bread, etc. After the consecration, the reality, the substance of the bread itself is no longer there, but the appearances of bread remain. So the molecular structure, the taste, the shape, texture, etc. The same is true for what once was wine. At the consecration, the reality or the substance of the wine is gone, and the external characteristics remain. And what has replaced that reality is the reality of Christ's body, blood, soul, and divinity. So the real presence only remains as long as the integrity of those external characteristics remains. So very quickly, both in the emulsification process in your mouth as you're receiving the host and it passes down into your stomach, the process of breaking it down happens very quickly. So really within a matter of only a couple of minutes, is the host, does it still have the properties of bread and therefore the real presence? So the real presence is no longer there very shortly after you receive Holy Communion. And there's nothing disrespectful or problematic about this bodily process, because after all, God made it. But to get back to your earlier question about why would reception on the tongue be considered more reverent in the tongue than in the hand, it would be simply a matter of custom and recognizing that we use our hands for mundane work and all sorts of things. Often they're dirty. And so it's sort of considered an extra way of showing reverence to the Lord by not having it put into our hands the way you might have a potato chip or something, but to have it put into your mouth. I ran out of time. I'll have to leave it at that. I'll be right back.